Good morning. My name is Michael McCusker. 5 days from now, 70 years ago, on January 30th, 1948, Mohandas K. Gandhi was assassinated. George Orwell, aka Eric Blair, wrote Reflections on Gandhi for the Partisan Review a year later, January 1949. Author of Animal Farm and 1984, Orwell died in 1950. Reflections on Gandhi by George Orwell. Saints should always be judged guilty until they are proved innocent, but the tests that have to be applied to them are not, of course, the same in all cases. In Gandhi's case, the question one feels inclined to ask are, to what extent was Gandhi moved by vanity, by the consciousness of himself as a humble, naked old man, sitting on a praying mat and shaking empires by sheer spiritual power? And to what extent did he compromise his own principles by entering into politics, which of their nature are inseparable from coercion and fraud? To give a definite answer, one would have to study Gandhi's acts and writings in immense detail, for his whole life was a sort of pilgrimage in which every act was significant. But this partial autobiography, which ends in the 1920s, is strong evidence in his favor, all the more because it covers what he would have called the unregenerate part of his life and reminds one that inside the saint or near saint, there was a very shrewd, able person who could, if he had chosen, have been a brilliant success as a lawyer, an administrator, or perhaps even a businessman. And the autobiography that Orwell was mentioning is The Story of My Experiments with Truth by M.K. Gandhi. At about the time when the autobiography first appeared, I remember reading its opening chapters in the ill-printed pages of some Indian newspaper. They made a good impression on me, which Gandhi himself, at that time, did not. The things that one associated with him, homespun cloth, soul forces, and vegetarianism, were unappealing, and his medievalist program was obviously not viable in a backward, starving, overpopulated country. It was also apparent that the British were making use of him, or thought they were making use of him. Strictly speaking, as a nationalist, he was an enemy, but since in every crisis he would exert himself to prevent violence, which, from the British point of view, meant preventing any effective action whatever, he could be regarded as our man, quote unquote. In private, this was sometimes cynically admitted. The attitude of the Indian millionaires was similar. Gandhi called upon them to repent, and naturally they preferred him to the socialists and communists who, given the chance, would actually have taken their money away. How reliable such calculations are in the long run is doubtful. As Gandhi himself says, in the end, deceivers deceive only themselves. But at any rate, the gentleness with which he was nearly always handled was due partly to the feeling that he was useful. The British conservatives only became really angry with him when, as in 1942, he was in effect turning his nonviolence against a different conqueror. But I could see even then that the British officials who spoke of him with a mixture of amusement and disapproval also genuinely liked and admired him after a fashion. Nobody ever suggested that he was corrupt or ambitious in any vulgar way, or that anything he did was actuated by fear or malice. In judging a man like Gandhi, one seems instinctively to apply high standards so that some of his virtues have passed almost unnoticed. For instance, it is clear, even from the autobiography, that his natural physical courage was quite outstanding. The manner of his death was a later illustration of this, for a public man who attached any value to his own skin would have been more adequately guarded. Again, he seems to have been quite free from that maniacal suspiciousness which, as E. M. Forster rightly says in A Passage to India, is the besetting Indian vice, as hypocrisy is the British vice. Although no doubt he was shrewd enough in detecting dishonesty, he seems wherever possible to have believed that other people were acting in good faith and had a better nature through which they could be approached. And though he came of a poor middle-class family, started life rather unfavorably, and was probably of unimpressive physical appearance, he was not afflicted by envy or by the feeling of inferiority. Color feeling, when he first met it in its worst form in South Africa, seems rather to have astonished him. Even when he was fighting what was in effect a color war, he did not think of people in terms of race or status. The governor of a province, a cotton millionaire, a half-starved Dravidian coolie, a British private soldier, were all equally human beings, to be approached in much the same way. It is noticeable that even in the worst possible circumstances, as in South Africa, when he was making himself unpopular as the champion of the Indian community, he did not lack in European friends. Written in short lengths for newspaper serialization, the autobiography is not a literary masterpiece, but it is the more impressive because of the commonplaceness of much of its material. It is well to be reminded that Gandhi started out with the normal ambitions of a young Indian student and only adopted his extremist opinions by degrees and, in some cases, rather unwillingly. There was a time, and it is interesting to learn, when he wore a top hat, took dancing lessons, studied French and Latin, went up the Eiffel Tower, and even tried to learn the violin. All this with the idea of assimilating European civilization as thoroughly as possible. He was not one of those saints who are marked out by their phenomenal piety from childhood onwards, nor one of the other kind who forsake the world after sensational debaucheries. He makes full confession of the misdeeds of his youth, but in fact there is not much to confess. As a frontispiece to the book, there is a photograph of Gandhi's possessions at the time of his death. The whole outfit could be purchased for about 5 lire, and Gandhi's sins, at least his fleshly sins, would make the same sort of appearance if placed all in one heap. A few cigarettes, a few mouthfuls of meat, a few annas pilfered in childhood from the maidservant, 2 visits to a brothel. On each occasion, he got away without, quote, doing anything. 1 narrowly escaped lapse with his landlady in Plymouth. 1 outburst of temper. That is about the whole collection. Almost from childhood onwards, he had a deep earnestness, an attitude ethical rather than religious, but until he was about 30, no very definite sense of direction. His first entry into anything describable as public life was made by way of vegetarianism. Underneath his less ordinary qualities, one feels all the time the solid middle-class businessmen who were his ancestors. One feels that even after he had abandoned personal ambition, he must have been a resourceful, energetic lawyer and a hard-headed political organizer, careful in keeping down expenses, an adroit handler of committees, and an indefatigable chaser of subscriptions. His character was an extraordinarily mixed one, but there was almost nothing in it that you can put your finger on and call bad. And I believe that even Gandhi's worst enemies would admit that he was an interesting and unusual man who enriched the world simply by being alive. Whether he was also a lovable man, and whether his teachings can have much value for those who do not accept the religious beliefs on which they are founded, I have never felt fully certain. Of late years, it has been the fashion to talk about Gandhi as though he were not only sympathetic to the Western left-wing movement, but even more integrally part of it. Anarchists and pacifists in particular have claimed him for their own, noticing only that he was opposed to centralism and state violence and ignoring the otherworldly, anti-humanist tendency of his doctrines. But one should, I think, realize that Gandhi's teachings cannot be squared with the belief that man is the measure of all things, and that our job is to make life worth living on this earth, which is the only earth we have. They make sense only in the assumption that God exists, and that the world of solid objects is an illusion to be escaped from. It is worth considering the disciplines which Gandhi imposed on himself, and which, though he might not insist on every one of his followers observing every detail, he considered indispensable if one wanted to serve either God or humanity. First of all, no meat eating, and if possible, no animal food in any form. Gandhi himself, for the sake of his health, had to compromise on milk, but seems to have felt this to be a backsliding. No alcohol or tobacco, and no spices or condiments, even of a vegetable kind, since food should be taken not for its own sake, but solely in order to preserve one's strength. Secondly, if possible, no sexual intercourse. If sexual intercourse must happen, then it should be for the sole purpose of begetting children, and presumably at long intervals. Gandhi himself, in his middle 30s, took the vow of brahmacharya, which means not only complete chastity, but the elimination of sexual desire. This condition, it seems, is difficult to attain without a special diet and frequent fasting. One of the dangers of milk drinking is that it is apt to arouse sexual desire. And finally, this is the cardinal point, for the seeker after goodness, there must be no close friendships and no exclusive loves whatever. Close friendships, Gandhi says, are dangerous because friends react on one another, he said. And through loyalty to a friend, one can be led into wrongdoing. This is unquestionably true. Moreover, if one is to love God or to love humanity as a whole, one cannot give one's preference to any individual person. This again is true, and it marks the point at which the humanistic and the religious attitudes cease to be reconcilable. To an ordinary human being, love means nothing if it does not mean loving some people more than others. The autobiography leaves it uncertain whether Gandhi behaved in an inconsiderate way to his wife and children, but at any rate, it makes clear that on three occasions he was willing to let his wife or a child die rather than administer the animal food prescribed by the doctor. It is true that the threatened death never actually occurred, and also that Gandhi, with, one gathers, a good deal of moral pressure in the opposite direction, always gave the patient the choice of staying alive at the price of committing a sin. Still, if the decision had been solely his own, he would have forbidden the animal food, whatever the risks might be. There must, he says, be some limit to what we will do in order to remain alive, and the limit is well on this side of chicken broth. This attitude is perhaps a noble one, but in the sense which, I think, most people would give to the word, it is inhuman. The essence of being human is that one does not seek perfection, that one is sometimes willing to commit sins for the sake of loyalty, that one does not push asceticism to the point where it makes friendly intercourse impossible, and that one is prepared in the end to be defeated and broken up by life, which is the inevitable price of fastening one's love upon other human individuals. No doubt alcohol, tobacco, and so forth are things that a saint must avoid, but sainthood is also a thing that human beings must avoid. There is an obvious retort to this, but one should be wary about making it. In this yogi-ridden age, it is too readily assumed that non-attachment is not only better than a full acceptance of earthly life, but that the ordinary man only rejects it because it is too difficult. In other words, that the average human being is a failed saint. It is doubtful whether this is true. Many people genuinely do not wish to be saints, and it is probable that some who achieve or aspire to sainthood have never felt much temptation to be human beings. If one could follow it to its psychological roots, one would, I believe, find that the main motive for non-attachment is a desire to escape from the pain of living, and above all, from love, which, sexual or non-sexual, is hard work. But it is not necessary here to argue whether the otherworldly or the humanistic ideal is higher. The point is that they are incompatible. One must choose between God and humanity, and all radicals and progressives, from the mildest liberal to the most extreme anarchist, have, in effect, chosen humanity. However, Gandhi's pacifism can be separated to some extent from his other teachings. Its motive was religious, but he claimed also for it that it was a definite technique, a method capable of producing desired political results. Gandhi's attitude was not that of most Western pacifists. Satyagraha, first evolved in South Africa, was a sort of nonviolent warfare, a way of defeating the enemy without hurting him and without feeling or arousing hatred. It entailed such things as civil disobedience, strikes, laying down in front of railway trains, enduring police charges without running away and without hitting back, and the like. Gandhi objected to passive resistance as a translation of satyagraha. In Gujarati, it seems, the word means firmness in the truth. In his early days, Gandhi served as a stretcher bearer on the British side in the Boer War, and he was prepared to do the same again in World War I. Even after he had completely abjured violence, he was honest enough to see that in war, it is usually necessary to take sides. He did not, indeed, since his whole political life centered around a struggle for national independence, he could not take the sterile and dishonest line of pretending that in every war, both sides are exactly the same, and it makes no difference who wins. Nor did he, like most Western pacifists, specialize in avoiding awkward questions. In relation to the late war, which was World War II, one question that every pacifist had a clear obligation to answer was, what about the Jews? Are you prepared to see them exterminated? If not, how do you propose to save them without resorting to war? I must say that I have never heard from any Western pacifist an honest answer to this question, though I have heard plenty of evasions, usually of the "you're another" type. But it so happens that Gandhi was asked a somewhat similar question in 1938, and that his answer is on record in Louis Fisher's Gandhi and Stalin. According to Fisher, Gandhi's view was that the German Jews ought to commit collective suicide, which, quote, would have aroused the world and the people of Germany to Hitler's violence. After the war, he justified himself. The Jews had been killed anyway and might as well have died significantly. One has the impression that this attitude staggered even so warm an admirer as Mr. Fisher, but Gandhi was merely being honest. If you are not prepared to take life, you must often be prepared for lives to be lost in some other way. When, in 1942, he urged nonviolent resistance against a Japanese invasion, he was ready to admit that it might cost several million lives. At the same time, there is reason to think that Gandhi, who after all was born in 1869, did not understand the nature of totalitarianism and saw everything in terms of his own struggle against the British. The important point here is not so much that the British government treated him forbearingly as that he was always able to command publicity. As can be seen from the phrase quoted above, he believed in arousing the world, which is only possible if the world gets a chance to hear what you are doing. It is difficult to see how Gandhi's methods could be applied in a country where opponents of the regime disappear in the middle of the night and are never heard of again. Without a free press and the right of assembly, it is impossible not merely to appeal to outside opinion, but to bring a mass movement into being or even to make your intentions known to your adversary. Is there a Gandhi in Russia at this moment? And if there is, what is he accomplishing? The Russian masses could only practice civil disobedience if the same idea happened to occur to all of them simultaneously. And even then, to judge by the history of the Ukraine famine, it would make no difference. But let it be granted that nonviolent resistance can be effective against one's own government or against an occupying power. Even so, how does one put it into practice internationally? Gandhi's various conflicting statements on World War II seems to show that he felt the difficulty of this. Applied to foreign politics, pacifism either stops being pacifist or becomes appeasement. Moreover, the assumption, which served Gandhi so well in dealing with individuals, that all human beings are more or less approachable and will respond to a generous gesture, needs to be seriously questioned. It is not necessarily true, for example, when you are dealing with lunatics. Then the question becomes, who is sane? Was Hitler sane? And is it not possible for one whole culture to be insane by the standards of another? And so far as one can gauge the feelings of whole nations, is there any apparent connection between a generous deed and a friendly response? Is gratitude a factor in international politics? These and kindred questions need discussion and need it urgently in the few years left to us before somebody presses the button and the rockets begin to fly. It seems doubtful whether civilization can stand another major war, and it is at least thinkable that the way out lies through nonviolence. It is Gandhi's virtue that he would have been ready to give honest consideration to the kind of question that I have raised above. And, indeed, he probably did discuss most of these questions somewhere or other in his innumerable newspaper articles. One feels of him that there was much that he did not understand, but not that there was anything that he was frightened of saying or thinking. I have never been able to feel much liking for Gandhi, but I do not feel sure that as a political thinker he was wrong in the main, nor do I believe that his life was a failure. It is curious that when he was assassinated, many of his warmest admirers exclaimed sorrowfully that he had lived just long enough to see his life work in ruins. Because India was engaged in a civil war, which had always been foreseen as one of the byproducts of the transfer of power. But it was not in trying to smooth down Hindu-Muslim rivalry that Gandhi had spent his life. His main political objective, the peaceful ending of British rule, had, after all, been attained. As usual, the relevant facts cut across one another. On the one hand, the British did get out of India without fighting, an event which very few observers, indeed, would have predicted until about a year before it happened. On the other hand, this was done by a Labour government, and it is certain that a Conservative government, especially a government headed by Churchill, would have acted differently. But if by 1945 there had grown up in Britain a large body of opinion sympathetic to Indian independence, how far was this due to Gandhi's personal influence? And if, as may happen, India and Britain finally settled down into a decent and friendly relationship, will this be partly because Gandhi, by keeping up his struggle obstinately and without hatred, disinfected the political air? That one even thinks of asking such questions indicates his stature. One may feel, as I do, a sort of aesthetic distaste for Gandhi. One may reject the claims of sainthood made on his behalf. He never made any such claim himself, by the way. One may also reject sainthood as an ideal and therefore feel that Gandhi's basic aims were anti-human and reactionary. But regarded simply as a politician, and compared with the other leading political figures of our time, how clean a smell he has managed to leave behind. And that was George Orwell, Reflections on Gandhi, who was assassinated 5 days from now, 70 years ago, on January 30th, 1948. And now I wish to pay tribute to my friend Richard Schultz, who died 25 years ago on his 41st birthday, January 23rd, 1993. Richard and Sharon McLean were driving from Astoria through the Coast Mountains when he lost control of the car on a snow-packed curve and hit a pickup truck head-on. Richard and Sharon were killed instantly, though the other driver escaped with minor injuries. Richard and Sharon were on their way to a birthday party in Portland, and his parents were hosting, and one can only imagine the shocked grief when word of his death reached them as they awaited his and Sharon's arrival. Richard worked for the Daily Astorian as an ad salesman, but he wrote poetry and experimental forms of what he called consciousness streaming for the marvelously original Abnormal Times, which was founded in Seaside in late 1987 and inscribed a quote from Ralph Waldo Emerson on its flag, "Imagination is not the talent of a few, but the health of all." Abnormal Times lasted only 4 issues, perishing, like Richard, too early. And I would like to read a few poems, 3 to be exact, by Richard Schultz. This one, in 1987, haiku. January sun warms the east wind coastal town. The ocean is flat. Lonely figures stand black against the sea gray sky. The cold fog is white. Cold rain blows sideways. His hands are red with fish blood. His nets need repair. And from 1988, Aster Visions. Walking through the seagulls and the fish guts in hot dumpster smell, looking at the river. Cannery workers sit on the pier, smoking, drinking coffee, their knee-high rubber boots flecked with fish guts and shrimp casings. Tired fishermen tie their boats to the pier, their eyes sore from looking at bright reflections on the water, their faces twisted with worry. And I, in my slacks and tie, carrying my briefcase, feeling stupid, embarrassed, inferior, my penny loafers slipping on fish slime. And smells like fish. Why continue to perform for tired smiles and sideways eyes, for white, soft, pudgy bodies bulging in two small shirts, for phony smiles, yellow teeth, and bad breath, for those who inspire only indifference? And the air smells like fish in our yawning industrial town. The sky grays, the river is gray, a cold wind begins to blow, and a soft, quiet rain creates an asphalt odor. And that was written in 1989. And as an epilogue, Oregon's greatest living writer, Ursula K. Le Guin, has died. She died January 22nd at age 88. She wrote in her 1972 book, The Farthest Shore, "You will die. You will not live forever, nor will any person or anything. Nothing is immortal, but only to us is it given to know that we must die, and that is a great gift, the gift of selfhood. For we have only what we know we must lose, what we are willing to lose. That selfhood, which is our torment and our treasure and our humanity, does not endure. It changes. It is gone. A wave on the sea. Would you have the sea grow still and the tides cease to save one wave, to save yourself?" And that was Ursula Le Guin. And this is Michael McCusker.